1960 was the year of the student sit-ins to desegregate lunch counters and restaurants. They began in Greensboro, North Carolina, when Joseph McNeil, a freshman at the Agricultural and Technical College of North Carolina, was refused service at the bus terminal lunch counter. His roommate, S.L. Blair, Jr., showed him a book that had been published about Martin and the bus boycott. Inspired by this, Blair, McNeil, and two other freshmen went to Woolworth's 5 and 10 on February 1st and sat there, quietly but insistently demanding service. Of course, they were refused, but they also refused to leave. Day after day, they went back and sat, joined by both black and white students coming from the Women's College of the University of North Carolina and Bennett College. The wire services picked up the story, and the movement spread like a forest fire. Within 2 weeks, black and white students in college towns, south from Virginia to Florida and west to Louisiana, organized sit-ins. Some were arrested, but this merely spread the flames. It was during these demonstrations that the song which was to become the anthem or symbol of the movement was first sung. It is based on a Negro church hymn which was first sung by black textile workers. During the 1940s, it was brought to Tennessee and later taken up by the students, and then by all of us. People sang it at one rally after another, until finally no rally could end without it. "We Shall Overcome," with new verses added all the time, was sung at sit-ins and by marchers, by demonstrators facing police dogs and fire hoses, in churches and paddy wagons, and in jailhouses throughout the South. It was so spirited and carried so much resolve and emotion that it gave people courage and determination. It became our anthem, the Marseillaise of the movement. It is difficult to describe how inescapably segregation pursued you, even though you instinctively tried to avoid putting yourself into situations where you would be insulted. Martin was once on a trip flying into Atlanta, well after he had achieved national recognition. He struck up a conversation with a white man sitting beside him on the plane, and they enjoyed their conversation together so much that his fellow passenger invited Martin to have lunch with him at the airport when they landed in Atlanta. Martin gladly accepted, and the two men went into the restaurant together. They asked for a table for two, and the hostess looked at Martin and said, "I'll have to seat you at a separate table." She directed Martin to an area behind a curtain and said, "Everything is the same. The food, the table, and the chairs are the same." My husband answered her kindly but firmly, "Oh, no, it is not the same. When you segregate me, you deprive me of fellowship with my brother here, when I want to continue to talk to him." He pointed to the decorated walls and said, "When I'm behind this curtain, you deprive me of the aesthetic pleasure of those paintings. It's not all the same." Of course, Martin was not willing to be seated behind a curtain, and he left. It was against just such discrimination that the students began to organize protest demonstrations. Their main target in Atlanta was Rich's Department Store, one of the largest in the South. They invited Martin to sit in at the lunch counter with them, and of course, he accepted with alacrity. There were about 75 students in the group on that particular day, and they were all arrested, Martin with them. It had been agreed in advance that if they were arrested, they would not put up bail, and most of them stayed in jail. Martin said, "I'll stay in jail 1 year or 10 years. If it takes that long to desegregate riches." By this time, Yoki and Marty were almost 5 and 3, respectively. This was to be the first time they were aware of his going to jail. They had heard the news on the radio as they were being driven home from nursery school. Yoki came home crying, and both of them asked me, "Why did Daddy go to jail?" I had been trying to prepare myself for this day, and now I said to them, Your daddy is a brave and kind man. He went to jail to help people. Some people don't have enough to eat, nor do they have comfortable homes in which to live, or enough clothing to wear. Daddy went to jail to make it possible for all people to have these things. Don't worry, your daddy will be coming back. Later, he went to jail in Albany in early December of 1961. The children were a year older, 6 and 4, when the news reached us by television. Yoki again cried because she feared her daddy would not be back for Christmas. This time, Marty consoled her. It was a deeply touching experience for me. Only 4 years old then, he sat on the side of the bed with one leg folded under the other, which hung off the side of the bed. He said, "Don't cry, Yoki. Daddy will be back. He has to help the people. He's already helped some people, but he has to help some more, and when he finishes, he'll be back. So don't cry, Yoki." One day, news spread through Atlanta that a settlement had been reached and that Martin and the students were going to be released. Then someone told me they had kept Dr. King in jail. Finally, I discovered what had happened. Back in April or May, Martin, who had neglected to change his Alabama driving license for one from Georgia, had been arrested for driving with an invalid license. It had happened one night when we had dinner and spent the evening with Lillian Smith, the eminent writer. Afterwards, we took her back to Emory University Hospital. On the way, a policeman stopped Martin simply because he had a white woman in the car. Then, when he saw that he was dealing with that well-known troublemaker, he issued a summons. This had happened in nearby DeKalb County, a well-known stronghold of the Klan. The next day, Martin and Daddy King went to answer the summons. Martin had been fined $25, given a suspended sentence, and released on probation. Somehow, he was not aware at the time of the suspended sentence. Now, when he was being released on the sit-in charges in Atlanta, DeKalb County officials came and asked for his custody, on the grounds that he had violated his probation by the sit-in. This was Saturday night. A hearing was set for Tuesday, and Martin stayed in jail. On Tuesday morning, the DeKalb County Sheriff came to the cell for him. He handcuffed Martin and walked arrogantly out with his prisoner. Naturally, the press photographers were alert. A picture of Martin handcuffed following behind the sheriff appeared in newspapers throughout the country. I went to the hearing at the DeKalb County Courthouse with Daddy King, Christine, and A.D. At the end of the proceedings, Judge Mitchell said, "I find the defendant guilty and sentence him to 6 months hard labor in the state penitentiary at Reidsville." It was a horrible shock to all of us. Obviously, a viciously unjust sentence for a traffic violation. It was hard to bear. I was 5 months pregnant and emotionally overwrought. Martin was immediately taken back to the jail cell. Daddy King and I were allowed to go to see him. I was trying not to cry when he went into the cell, but the tears were streaming down my face. When Martin saw me, he said, "Corey, dear, you have to be strong. I've never seen you like this before. You have to be strong for me." Then I realized that Martin had been weakened by his days in jail and was greatly depressed by this unexpected shock. He was relying on the deep reservoir of strength which I had always drawn from in crisis situations. But I, too, was totally unprepared for the dreadful decision. Daddy King said, "You don't see me crying. I'm ready to fight. When you see Daddy crying, Coretta, then you can start crying. I'm not taking this lying down." So he said, but he was emotionally affected. Later, Martin told me that at 4:30 the following morning, several men had come into the jail cell where he was sleeping with the other prisoners. They played a flashlight on his face and called, "King! King! Wake up! It was frightening. Again, he knew only the awful history of such midnight visits, and nothing of where they were taking him. They made him dress and handcuffed him very tightly and put chains around his legs. He rode the 300 miles to Reidsville in those painful handcuffs and chains without knowing what his fate would be. When he got to Reidsville, exhausted and humiliated, he was thrown into a very narrow cell where hardened criminals were kept and then made to put on a prison uniform. The next day, the telephone rang. The person at the other end said, "May I speak to Mrs. Martin Luther King, Jr.?" "Just a minute, Mrs. King, for Senator Kennedy." Senator John F. Kennedy was in the final days of his campaign for President of the United States. I waited a few seconds, and a voice made familiar by scores of television broadcasts said, "Good morning, Mrs. King. This is Senator Kennedy." We exchanged greetings, and then Senator Kennedy said, "I want to express to you my concern about your husband. I know this must be very hard for you. I understand you are expecting a baby, and I just wanted you to know that I was thinking about you and Dr. King. If there's anything I can do to help, please feel free to call on me." "I certainly appreciate your concern," I said. "I would appreciate anything you could do to help." Well, things began to happen pretty fast after that. I heard that Robert Kennedy called Judge Mitchell to learn why Dr. King couldn't be released on bail pending appeal. That story leaked out to the press, and evidently Judge Mitchell had a change of heart. Now he said Martin would be released on bail. I received the news about Martin's release around noon the next day, and I was very, very happy. A few days later, John Kennedy was elected President of the United States by only about 100,000 votes. It is my belief that historians are right when they say that his intervention in Martin's case won the presidency for him. In January 1963, my husband, Ralph Abernathy, and Fred Shuttlesworth had a conference with President Kennedy and Attorney General Robert Kennedy at the White House to urge the federal government to initiate civil rights legislation in 1963. The Kennedys were, as always, sympathetic, but they said they had no plans for proposing any civil rights legislation in 1963. The president said he was going to propose some important domestic legislation, and he feared that anything in the civil rights area would divide the Congress and imperil these bills. Naturally, Martin was very disappointed. He felt he had no choice but to go ahead with his plans to force a confrontation in Birmingham so that the federal government would have to act. He frankly told the president his intentions, because if white violence erupted, we would need the support and help of the federal government. He wanted the president to be informed in advance. The protests started on April 3, 1963, with lunch counter sit-ins. In the first 3 days alone, 35 people were arrested. On Saturday, April 6, an orderly march of carefully selected demonstrators moved toward City Hall. They were stopped 3 blocks from their goal. 42 people were arrested for parading without a permit. They were politely escorted to the paddy wagon and driven to jail. They were singing freedom songs while thousands of Negroes cheered them from the sidewalks. After that, demonstrations were staged every day with increasing strength. Thus far, Bull Connor's police had behaved very well while making the arrests. Between 400 and 500 black people were arrested, and though some got out on bail, about 300 remained in jail. During this time, Martin was trying to get the merchants and the Birmingham city officials to negotiate our very moderate demands: desegregation of store facilities, upgrading and hiring of Negroes on a non-discriminatory basis, dropping of charges against the imprisoned protesters, and creation of a biracial committee to work out a timetable for further desegregation in Birmingham. The businessmen were willing to negotiate at this point. The city officials were not. On Wednesday, these city officials obtained an injunction against the demonstrators, but it was issued by an Alabama state court, not a federal court. Martin promptly announced that the injunction would be disobeyed. He pointed out that the Negroes were not anarchists advocating lawlessness, but that the courts of Alabama had misused the judicial process. He said that we could not in good conscience obey their mandate. As a countermove, the courts announced that bail bonds would no longer be accepted, but that it would be necessary to post cash. As it happened, our organization was fresh out of cash. Martin had set Good Friday, April 12th, for the day that he and some of the other leaders would provoke arrest by breaking the injunction. He had deliberately chosen that day because of its symbolic and religious significance. When I got the news that Martin had been arrested that Friday afternoon, I just knew he would telephone me from jail, which was always the first thing he did after he was arrested. No call came. All the next day, I waited. Then it was Easter Sunday morning. Still, I had heard nothing. In desperation, I telephoned Wyatt Walker in Birmingham. He said, "Coretta, I haven't been able to get a phone message through to Martin. I've tried all day. They are not even allowing his lawyers to see him now. They're holding him incommunicado. I think you ought to call the president." I called the White House several times to see if I could get a number in West Palm Beach, where the president was reportedly staying. But each time the operator would say, "I have no number for the president or members of his family at West Palm Beach." I thought, now whom should I call? I told the operator to try Vice President Johnson, but he too was out of the city. Quite frantically, I said, there must be someone I could call who would help me to get to the president. Since she was a kind and sympathetic woman, the operator said, "What about Pierre Salinger?" Immediately, I reached Pierre Salinger, who told me that he would make every effort to get in touch with the president and get him to call me. Later, the telephone rang. And when I answered, a familiar voice said, "Mrs. King, this is Attorney General Robert Kennedy. I am returning your call to my brother. The president wasn't able to talk to you because he's with my father, who is quite ill. He wanted me to call you to find out what we can do for you." I poured out a rush of words. "I was calling because I'm concerned about my husband. As you probably know, he is in jail in Birmingham, and he's been there since Friday. At this point, no one is able to see him. Usually they let him telephone me, but I have heard nothing from him directly. I understand that he and Reverend Abernathy are being held incommunicado, and I'm awfully worried. I wondered if the president could check into the situation and see if he's all right." I tried to make it clear that I was concerned about Martin's safety and was not asking for his release. I explained that at first they had allowed his lawyer to talk with him, and that it was my understanding that Martin was sleeping on bare steel springs without blankets or a pillow. It was not until the next day, Monday, that I heard anything more. At about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the telephone rang, and as I picked up the receiver, I heard little 2-year-old Dexter babbling away on the extension. The operator said, "Will you get your child off the telephone, please?" I had someone get him off the phone and waited until a voice came on saying, "Hello, Mrs. King. I'm sorry I wasn't able to talk to you yesterday. I understand my brother called you. I just wanted you to know that I was with my father, who is ill and couldn't leave him." By that time, I realized it was President Kennedy. He said, I know you'll be interested in knowing that we sent the FBI into Birmingham last night. We checked on your husband, and he's all right. And the president said, of course, Birmingham is a very difficult place. He talked a little while about the situation there and the city officials. Then he added, I want you to know we're doing everything we can. I've just talked to Birmingham, and your husband will be calling you shortly. If you have any further worries about your husband or about Birmingham in the next few days, I want you to feel free to call me. You can get me or my brother or Mr. Salinger. You know how to get me now. I could hardly thank him enough. What a relief he had brought to my heart. I could hardly wait for the telephone to ring. Within 15 minutes, Martin called. It was almost like a new miracle. Are you all right, my dear? I asked. Martin told me he was all right, but he sounded so tired. He usually fasted when he was in jail. There was no energy in his voice. We talked a little before I told him about my phone conversation with the president. There was a sort of smile in Martin's voice as he said, So that's why everybody's suddenly being so polite. This is good to know. Martin was in jail for 8 days. While in prison, he wrote his famous open letter, a letter from a Birmingham jail, to a group of 8 white Alabama clergymen who had issued a statement calling the protest unwise and untimely, and had criticized Martin as an outside agitator who had come to Birmingham seeking publicity. Martin wrote the letter on the margins of newspapers and scraps of toilet paper. He said, I am in Birmingham because injustice is here. Then he delved deeply into his whole philosophy of the movement and what he believed the attitude of the Christian churches should be toward it. He wrote that in the same way that one should obey just laws, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. And he quoted Saint Augustine saying, an unjust law is no law at all. On Saturday, April 20th, Ralph Abernathy and Martin were released from jail. That very evening at the Gaston Motel, a leadership conference hit upon the brilliant scheme of enlisting the black school children of Birmingham in the Crusade for Freedom. Martin realized that he would be severely criticized for using our children in this fashion, but he thought that the time had come to give the movement a dramatic new dimension. In addition, he felt that it was the children who would benefit most from desegregation, that it was the children for whom we were fighting, and that taking part in the movement would give them a sense of worth and dignity and increase their spiritual values. At the same time, everything possible would be done to protect them from physical danger. Andy Young, Bernard Lee, Jim Bevel, and others went recruiting to all the high schools of Birmingham, as well as the Negro colleges. And the children responded by the thousands. They attended mass meetings and training sessions in the philosophy and techniques of nonviolence. Even children too young to march asked for a place in our ranks. Andy Young told them, You are too young to go to jail. Go to the library. You'll learn something there. 6 small children shyly followed his advice, and all by themselves desegregated the library because no one dared touch them. On D-Day, May 2nd, Martin addressed a group of eager youngsters at the 16th Street Baptist Church. Then they marched downtown singing as they came. They were all arrested. Wave after wave of children marched off singing to suffer the same treatment. 959 young people were arrested that day. We shall overcome. The next morning, Martin announced, Yesterday was D-Day in Birmingham. Today will be double D-Day. With the spotlight of the nation on him, Bull Connor was becoming desperate. He massed police in the street around the 16th Street Church. As 1,000 children and teenagers marched toward them, he ordered the fire hoses open. Jets of water under 100 pounds of pressure knocked the children flat, ripping the clothes off some of them. Then Connor unleashed the police dogs. They ran wild, biting the children. The youngsters maintained nonviolence, but it was too much for some of our people who watched in agony from the rooftops. They began to throw rocks. Late Sunday afternoon, the late Reverend Charles Billups led a group of adults from the New Pilgrim Baptist Church to the police barricade. They knelt in the street and prayed. Then they walked forward. Bull Connor himself arrived and ordered Reverend Billups to turn back. Billups refused, and his people shouted, "Turn on the water hose, loose the dogs. We ain't going back. Forgive them, O Lord." In a fury, Bull Connor shouted, "Turn on the hoses, damn it." But a miraculous thing happened. As the black people rose from their knees and moved forward, Connor's men, with the hoses sagging in their hands, fell back to each side. The moral pressure of a watching world and the spiritual force of that little band of blacks broke their discipline, disarmed them. Between their ranks, past the leashed dogs, Billups led his people. They held a prayer meeting in a nearby park and marched back to their church singing freedom songs. It was the first crack in the morale of the racist forces. All the next week, the children's crusade continued. Birmingham's jails were full. The arrested young people were held in stockades or halls. Finally, there were too many to cope with. As 500 youngsters marched on Tuesday, the police broke up the demonstration but arrested no one. 3,000 people, mostly youngsters, infiltrated past the police by different routes and marched around the downtown streets, in and out of the stores, singing, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, and I'm on my way to Freedom Land." Governor Wallace called out the National Guard. On May 4th, President Kennedy sent Burke Marshall to Birmingham to try to negotiate a settlement. On Friday, May 10th, an agreement was announced. It was almost word for word an acceptance of the original demands of the movement. The stores were to be desegregated, hiring of Negroes upgraded, charges dropped, and the Senior Citizens Committee or the Chamber of Commerce would meet regularly with black leaders to reconcile their differences. Birmingham represented a real victory for the movement because the officials of the city and the white merchants sat down with the black leadership and negotiated a settlement. The victory had broad implications. Martin's long-range strategy in going into Birmingham was to focus national attention on the grave injustices endured by Negroes and to bring about federal legislation. My husband had written that Birmingham was the colossus of segregation. A victory there would radiate across the South, cracking the whole edifice of discrimination. And it happened as he had predicted. Within a few months, nearly 1,000 cities were engulfed in the turmoil of change. Except for the Civil War and the Reconstruction, black people had never acted along such a broad front in a direct action drive to alter the conditions of their lives. Nearly 1 million Negroes with their white allies had marched or otherwise demonstrated in the streets of hundreds of cities in that historic summer. By its end, thousands of public accommodations were wedged open, and a new chapter in race relations was begun. Objectively, exclusion was narrowed. Subjectively, the confidence of Negroes was widened and deepened. This confidence was later to become the foundation for black pride and slogans of black power.
The fall of Birmingham was a turning point, almost too significant to be grasped at the time of its happening. Politically, as a result of the struggles there, President Kennedy reassessed the position of his administration and decided to propose a civil rights bill in 1963. It was eventually passed by Congress in 1964. At a press conference on the proposed bill at the White House, President Kennedy said to Martin with a wry grin, "Bull Connor has done as much for civil rights as Abraham Lincoln."